This is GNU World Order, Episode 8 of Season 11. There's a little utility that I kind of stumbled across, and I knew about it already. I sort of rediscovered it, I guess, when someone else was using it. And I've started to kind of really latch on to it because it really is a great utility. And so many of us, I think, forget about it because for whatever reason. And it's called LSBlock, or LSBLK, really. And that is list block devices, which kind of is a horrible name for a utility, I think. I mean, it's not a horrible name, but for most computer users, it's a horrible name, because I don't think most people, if I said, so, can you list your block devices? I don't honestly think many people would have any clue as to what that means. But it is a really nice little utility, and if you just type it in, you'll see what it does, but it lists all attached hard drives, or block devices. and I say block devices because it's not just a hard drive. It would show your DVD drive or something like that as well, if there was media in the DVD drive. Or maybe it would show it either way. I'm not sure. I haven't used it with an optical drive enough. But LSBLK is a really nice sort of substitute for the canonical dmessage pipe tail, or whatever, however you do it. I'm struggling here because I don't have permission to view dmessage. There we go. Dmessage pipe tail, which, you know, we kind of tell new users, okay, do your dmessage pipe tail, and then plug in your hard drive, and then do your dmessage pipe tail again, and then whatever the S, you know, look for something called SD or whatever, and that, the one that wasn't there before, or, you know, the it should show up at the bottom of your dmessage, and that's the name of your device. And while that works, it totally is functional. List block devices is actually really, really a lot more, it's a lot more direct. See, I don't want to just say, like, blanket, it's a lot more user-friendly, because that doesn't mean anything. It's a lot more direct, because dmessage tail, it gives you, like, some kind of weird timestamp, or whatever those numbers are on the left, of when this message was logged, and it tells you that it's a kernel event or something. You know, maybe I'm thinking of UDEV, but I mean, it gives you a lot of information, and it's kind of like, it's not overkill, but it's a lot of information to parse. That's what it is, because it kind of speaks in complete sentences, complete computer sentences, and really all you want to know, all you want your new user that you're trying to guide through this process to give you is the SD A, B, C, D, whatever. You know, that's the part that you want to know. And then dmessage also doesn't make it super clear as to the relationship between SDA and SDA1, or, you know, SDX and SDX1, SDX2. It doesn't really kind of elaborate on that. Whereas if you do an LSBLK, it even has, like, little Unicode graphics, you know, it's got, like, it's a tree, it's like that, it's called tree, actually. I was trying to remember what the name of the thing was, and then I typed in tree in a very, very, populated directory, so it gives you, like, the little lines, you know, so it says the name of the device is SDA, and then a little line, a little arrow pointing from SDA down to SDA1, so there's clear inheritance. SDA is some kind of top-level name, and SDA1 is a child of that SDA parent. And it even tells you what type it is. Is it type disk, or is it type partition, or is it type read-only media, ROM? and it tells you the mount point. So where is SDA1? Well, on this computer right here, it's slash. And then SDC1 is user local, and SDC2 is user share, and SDC3 is var, and so on and so forth. And it tells you all of that information in one screen. It tells you the size of the disk, or the volume, I should say. It tells you the size of the partition. I mean, it's a really, really succinct and practical kind of display of exactly the information that we're really looking for when we're trying to help a new user or ourselves to identify media. And I used to really kind of be over nervous, and I still honestly am, because it's healthy to be, but I used to be sort of almost obsessive compulsive about, okay, I'm plugging in this thumb drive. This thumb drive is 4 gigabytes. I know this, so I'm going to plug it in, and I'm looking at DMessage. Okay, so it says it's SDE. All right, so SDE. All right, I'm going to make sure that SDA is really 4 gigs, so I'm going to go parted slash dev slash SDE print, just to make sure, or parted print dev SDE, just to make sure that when I'm about to nuke dev SDE, I want to make darn sure that it's that 4 gigabyte thumb drive that I just plugged in, because I do not want to nuke something that I'm not intending to nuke. So I used to be very, very kind of like lots and lots of checks and rechecks, but LSBLK, it just kind of tells you all that information. It's like SDE, yes, it's a 4 gig disk, and it has one partition on it, which is 4 gigs, and it's a partition, and it's mounted at slash run slash media slash clatu slash foo, and you just you know exactly where it is and exactly which one. You know, you're not going to get it mixed up with the 8 gig thumb drive that you also have plugged in, or the 12 gig partition drive that you have in your tower, whatever. You're not going to mix it up as easily, because it is very, very clear and very, very precise. So if you don't use LSBLK, get used to it. It's really, really nice tool. You should start using it. It's just so darned useful. And I don't know why, like, I'm sure I had heard of it before, but I was watching someone else do some stuff, and they did the LSBLK command, and it just kind of hit me that was the command I'd always been looking for to identify media on a computer. So check out LSBLK. It's very useful. Another little handy utility that I've been using lately that I hadn't really used in the past, I might have opened it up honestly by accident in the past, but lately I've been using it a lot more because, so at my new job, I, believe it or not, have to use SVN, which, I mean, I thought that I'd come into the computer game late enough in life, I mean, in the life of computing, that I would never have to use SVN. Like, I'd missed that era of computing. SVN was not a thing that I would have to worry about. I got introduced to version control management, version control systems with Git, and I figured that was probably going to be the only thing I would ever need to know. For some reason, the job that I have right now, for some reason, they're using SVN. I mean, the reason is obvious. I mean, it's just, it's been around, and it's the thing that they've been using, and they just haven't had time to migrate to Git. And you don't really, if it's not broke, don't fix it. So I've had the pleasure of sort of getting to know SVN, and you might say that I've gotten closer to it than I want to, but I mean, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world, it's just not at all very good. So SVN has been an interesting thing, and one of the things about SVN is that its diff system just really doesn't exist. And there's an argument there, obviously, that it shouldn't exist, that the Unix philosophy sort of demands that it doesn't exist, and I can see that. But merge conflicts without some kind of interface for diffing has been a little bit troubling to me. And I'm not saying that SVN doesn't have it, I'm just saying that I don't know what it is. And so what I've been doing is that I've been taking... And merge conflicts, from what I can tell, and I could be wrong, from what I can tell, they happen a lot more in SVN. Maybe it's just the workflow has changed, but I've encountered it more whilst using SVN than in the past many, many years of me using Git. And again, maybe it's just the workflow shift, because this is a different way of working. So that could be it. But at my previous, at the job that I came to New Zealand for, I was using Git in a very large active environment and really didn't have that issue. So I'm not sure if it's sort of normal with SVN, if it's not really a merge conflict, it's just kind of like part of the merging process, or if it is, like I say, just a workflow change. But either way, with Git, when there's a merge conflict, you get dumped into sort of this into your editor of choice, and you go through your editor and you find where the conflicts have happened and you correct them, and then you continue your commit, and that's really sort of all there is to it. It's a little bit scary the first time it happens, but I mean it's almost intuitive, I feel, and I'm not, it's not intuitive. It's almost disturbing, because it drops you into your editor and you see these characters, you know, these greater than, less than characters pointing out the conflicts, and you think, you know, it looks like it's corrupted your file, you know, it looks disturbing. So it's not intuitive, but for someone who's used to it, that's what I'm used to. That's kind of like, okay, merge conflict, edit, correct, done. SVN doesn't seem to do that as much, and I'm not exactly sure the correct way to resolve all these things. And the way that I've done it is that I'll check out the old version, you know, the version that I'm conflicting with, and I'll have my version, and I need to somehow merge those two files, or you know, sort of make those two agree with one another in some way. And so the tool that I've been using for that is a tool that you've probably heard of, you may have used, but it's called Compare, but it's called K-O-M-P-A-R-E. It's a GUI diffing tool, and I'm sure that these are a dime a dozen, and there are probably several that I'm ignoring that I wouldn't even have to open up a GUI with. But nevertheless, that's what I'm using, and it's quite nice, actually. When you first launch Compare, it asks you to define your source and your destination. And that confused me at first, because I thought, well, there is no source or destination, or there are two sources, and I want a third destination, so it was kind of confusing. But it really, if you think about it, it's sort of like old versus new. So your source would be the old version of the file that you're conflicting with, and the destination would be the new one that you want to sort of... that's the one that you want to be new and made complete. At least that's how I've been doing it. You could probably do it the other way around just as easily. So it's not really a source and destination, but it kind of is, because there's the source and then there's the destination, and the destination is the one that's going to get all the new data saved into it. And that was a little bit exciting for me as well, because it kind of, I thought, wow, I'm going to be able to actually produce a new, you know, a complete file from this, like that this is going to be creating something that will have all the information that I need in it, and that is and then I'll be done that process, which is kind of nice. So once you define those two files, then you can open them. Compare will open them for you, really, in a very, very attractive interface that shows you the new information in each, you know, the unique information in each file. But it's less, I would say, I guess less terse than, for instance, diff on a command line, where you literally just kind of see the differences. And that's kind of what I'm kind of comparing this to is yeah, like diff, where you see the differences between the two things, but you don't really see them in all that much context. I mean, unless you make it be in context. And there's not really a way to resolve it then and there. You know, you see the differences and then you're aware of them and then you can do things about those things. But in compare, like I say, the exciting thing for me, at least, is that it's interactive. It's, you see the differences and you can accept changes and merge changes. And then at the end, you can save everything out and it saves the thing to your destination file and you're done. And now you have a complete merged file that you can then, you know, do whatever you need to do with it. And I kind of got so used to the compare tool through, you know, working around my lack of understanding of SVN that I've actually used it in real life as well, outside of the job, for things that I'm working on, that, you know, instructions and articles and things that I work on, where maybe I have progressive, you know, I'm writing a sample program or something, a sample script, and you kind of want to deliver that to the reader at, you know, a couple steps at a time. So I have this master script, but then I have the steps that are broken down from that, and I've been using that as a way to kind of compile, to make sure that all my steps get back to the original script. So yeah, I've actually been using it in the real world, is what I'm trying to say. And yeah, I like the tool. It's really actually quite elegant, and I think I think it's pretty intuitive, to be honest. I mean, I'd never used it before, and I didn't really know what was going on. And other than the source versus destination terminology, which I don't know if I don't know if I. It does work, because in the end you do save a file and it saves it to the destination. I guess in my mind I really want it to be an issue of three files being created, or three files being dealt with, the old, the new, and then the merged. But that's not how it does it, so throw that out. And aside from that, I feel it's pretty intuitive, and the GUI itself is quite fluid. You know, I mean, the matter of diffing is a really crazy kind of concept. Like, to someone who doesn't deal with diffs on a regular basis, it's kind of staggering that a computer can deliver to you the difference between two files. Like, how does it do that? Like, surely if you've added a sentence, then that throws the rest of the file off. And it's just the fact that it can keep resynchronizing is really, really cool. And that's what compare shows you. Like, if you have 100 lines, and then in the middle of that 100 line, you've got a big new paragraph that you wrote, it the way, you know, you're scrolling through it, and it keeps the things in lines completely, and it resyncs it, and it's gorgeous. It's really, really nice. Very fluid. It is a super nice application. So if you're ever finding yourself at a loss for, you know, merging two files or comparing very similar files that maybe you forgot what you'd done on one and didn't do on the other, whatever, open it up and compare and see if it can make sense of it, because it really is slick. And then my final utility tip for the show is SVN related as well, and I apologize, but it's not exclusively SVN related. I'm apologizing because I don't feel like anyone else in their right mind is using SVN, but it's not exclusive to SVN, and I may have mentioned this before, but I included this in an article that I wrote a while ago now, actually, and I was really surprised at just how many people didn't know that this existed. But if you go into, if you're using KDE, and you should be, let's be honest, you know you should be deep down, you go to setting, you open up Dolphin, that's the file manager, you go into settings, configure Dolphin, and you go down to services. Services are all the different plugins of Dolphin. Dolphin is a shockingly extensible file manager. It's the kind of file manager that I used to wish that I had on my old OS before I switched to Linux. And you would find these like shareware programs that would sort of expand on the Finder or try to replace the Finder altogether, my old OS. And it was always so cool to see what was possible in a file manager, you know? It's like, oh my gosh, like this changes the way I interface with my computer. And it really does, because like the desktop, that's the main interface for computers for most people. And to a certain degree, for us, when we, even as geeks, like, you know, you do, unless you live in a command line, and I don't believe anyone in the modern world does, because there's too much that's in a web browser at this point, and there's too much in the web browser that's not going to translate very well into a shell. These are things that I know from experience. So generally speaking, you know, we're all opening up a file manager at some point. Maybe not as much as we used to, but we do. So it's our interface, and so Dolphin is extremely, extremely extensible. You may have to install an extra package that's, I think, called Dolphin add-ons or Dolphin plugins or Dolphin extras, something like that. But I mean, to get like the full list, but by default there's quite a few. But if you install more, you can do a lot of really cool things with it. And in Slackware, it's already installed, so I don't have to install anything extra. I just have to go in and activate them. I have to turn them on. And the things that I turn on usually are, well, first, and perhaps most pertinent, is the Git plugin. Yes, you can view Git repositories. I mean, obviously you can view Git repositories, but I mean, you can view Git repositories with all of the information that Git contains, and you can even do a bunch of actions for Git just through Dolphin. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that Dolphin is a graphical interface for Git. I kid you not. So if you activate the Git plugin, there's also a Mercurial, there's also SVN, commit and update commands for Dolphin, and a couple more. You know, there's like probably, I think, well, there's Dropbox if you use that. I don't. I have it active just in case, but I don't use it. Oh, Bazaar. That was the other one that I was thinking. So Bazaar. So, yeah, and then you go out into Dolphin, and for instance, if you go, I don't have an SVN folder on this computer, but that doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be SVN. So here's a Git folder, and each Git item that has been committed and pushed has a little green check mark by it. If I wanted to do some kind of Git action in this directory, I could click out in the empty space, and I could do, well, here's a Git pull, here's a Git push, Git create tag, Git checkout. I don't need to do any of those things. If I right-click on a file, I can do, for instance, let's see, a Git add. I can't do that right now, but a Git remove, I could do a delete through Git. And then once I'd done that, of course, I could do a Git add, because I would need to add what I just had done, and then I could do a Git push, or a Git commit rather, and then a Git push. And that's all just from right-clicking and entering information right here within Dolphin. It's pretty magical, and I have been using that a little bit, not for Git, but for the SVN equivalents at work. Because it's just easy. It's easy to do it. And I do have to interface with some things that I can't interface through the shell at work. So I end up using the file manager at work a lot more than I do in my personal life. But yeah, the Dolphin plugins rather are amazing, and you should absolutely use them. If you're not aware of them, make sure that you install them and yeah, check them out. They're really, really useful. All right, I think it's probably time for a coffee break, so let's do that, and then we'll come back and talk about DNS. little bit of Python talk here. I know that I haven't really talked about Python all that much lately, and on one hand, I want to provide more Python, but on the other hand, I don't want to just turn this into a Python podcast either, so it's a balancing act. But this one is an interesting one because it took me ages to actually learn this thing that I'm about to reveal to you. Turns out Python has a graphical IDE built into it. I know a lot of you are probably saying, yes, I already knew that. And others are saying, no way. And no, it's true. It's got a graphical IDE that comes along with the Python distribution, with the caveat that it depends on how Python is packaged for your distribution. So you and I probably know the editor or the interface called IDLE. And the way that I was introduced to IDLE was that you type in Python on the command line, or Python 3, whichever you're using. I'm using Python 3, so let's go with that. Python 3. And then you get the three chevrons, greater than, symbols. And that's IDLE. That you're in IDLE now. That's the shell, the interactive command prompt of Python. That's IDLE. And I guess that must be true, or I've been misinformed, but there is another. So, if you type in IDLE or IDLE 3 on your, into your terminal and hit return, you should see a new window pop up, and it'll be called the Python shell. And it will have its own little, you know, its little three chevrons, and you can do all the different things that you would do in a Python shell, like print hello world, print parentheses, quote, hello world, close quote, close parentheses, to be specific. So that's, you know, what I would call IDLE. But it turns out there's a lot more to it than just that. And in... Now, if you don't see what I'm talking about, like if you've just typed in IDLE or IDLE 3 and your computer says no, then you may have to install something called Python, I think, -tools or Python-utils, something like that. I would have to look on a different machine. I'm on Slackware right now, and it just has it bundled with it, so that's nice, but not all of them do. Like my Fedora box, I think it was Python tools, Python-3-tools. So to get IDLE and a couple of other things, or this graphical IDLE is what I'll have to call it. So I looked up what IDLE actually meant, and it stands for Integrated Development and Learning Environment. That's what IDLE actually stands for. I never really honestly thought about it, but it is sort of essentially an IDE for Python. And as IDEs go, it's pretty lightweight. I mean, it's an IDE in the same sense maybe that gedit or kate is an IDE. You know, it is, but at the same time, you know, it's not what you really think of when you think of an IDE. And that was kind of deceptive, I guess, in terms of when I would search for Python IDEs, especially trying to find the cross-platform ones, an IDLE would come up. And first of all, I didn't think IDLE was a graphical entity at all. I thought it was just the command line thing that would just pop up in your terminal after you type in Python. But yeah, you know, if you're thinking, oh, Eclipse, that's an IDE, or Qt Creator, that's an IDE, or Kdevelop, that's an IDE, that's not what IDLE really is. But there is a lot more to IDLE than just an interactive prompt, as it turns out. So you can, if you're in IDLE, you can go to the File menu and click New File, and now you've got a new window, and it's a text editor. And this text editor features syntax highlighting. It features command completion, I think, to some degree. I don't remember exactly how much, but I'm pretty sure I've seen it pop up at some point. It's not really working for me right now, but that's okay. Maybe I just don't have anything for it to complete. But it definitely has syntax highlighting, which is, you know, in itself pretty nice. It's got the automatic indent, so that if you start a for loop, for instance, the next line is indented already, so that you kind of get some help there. It doesn't seem to close the for loops or the indent. It doesn't dedent very well, but presumably, I mean, I think dedenting is easier even for a new Python user than indenting. I think the indenting thing is a little bit confusing compared to just like, okay, go, you know, back out of this clause. And then when you're finished, you have a run menu. So you've got a run module menu, which is also bound to F5. So you click that, and it will run your little application in what I would call an idle, you know, an based on the, like, your console, I guess, your Python console. So it's really, really pretty cool. It's got all the sort of typical necessary Python formatting features, you know, like you can, so if you've realized that, oh, this whole section needs to be in a function all of its own, so you could create a function, def foo, paren colon, and then you would select the stuff that you'd need to be in that function, and then you'd go to format and select indent region, and then it moves the entire region, you know, over with indents relative to how indented they need to be. So quite some really nice features there. Then there are apparently some plugins for idle too, so that you can actually get some things that are kind of like shockingly not there already. For instance, line numbers. There are no line numbers in it for some weird reason. Like in a text editor specifically designed for programming, I don't know. I would have thought that line numbers would have been something that would have been included. But and anyway, I'm talking about this. I'm speaking about this idle discovery, not really because I necessarily recommend it. It's something that I feel like every Python web page or book I look at, it always talks about idle, you know, and it never, ever, ever differentiates between idle, the prompt, the interactive prompt that you get in a terminal, versus idle, the GUI application written into Kinter that appears on screen if you type in idle or idle 3 on the terminal. And those are, it's disturbingly, I mean, I've been doing Python for I don't know how long at this point. I mean, certainly over 3 years, like, professionally, I guess, if you want to say that. I mean, I've gotten money for Python code, so whatever you call that, for 3 years, and never knew about this. And then, you know, years before that, I had been trying to teach myself Python. So I've gone through a lot of material, and I never realized that there was a graphical interface for all this stuff. And the way I found out was like this 11-year-old kid or 12-year-old kid in one of my my partner's classrooms, like one of her programming classes, kept talking about idle, and I looked into it and discovered that, yes, idle exists. And there's a text editor, and it's got syntax highlighting. I mean, that's half the battle right there, I feel. Like, if you're trying to teach people Python on different platforms, I think, really, honestly, half the battle is trying to figure out which stupid text editor you're going to standardize everyone on, because you can't. You know, I mean, I've traditionally said, here's a USB stick, boot into Slacks, and now we'll all use Kate. And that's it. Job done. And that's worked really, really well. But depending on your resources, you know, like, can you expect people to actually do that? Can you control your environment? Are the computers at this location going to be so locked down that you can't boot into, you know, boot off of USB because you need some kind of BIOS password? Those are variables that have been kind of huge blockers in the past for me. So having the ability to just say, okay, we've gotten Python 3 installed, that's the hurdle. Everything after that, we've got covered, because we have Python 3. We can use pip for the different modules that we need, pip 3 really, for the different modules that we need. We can use idle for our text editing platform, so we don't have to worry about, you know, which editor is actually cross-platform enough for us to use, or even whether we can install an extra text editor or not. So yeah, it's been a great discovery, and I just kind of wanted to mention that it exists, so that if you, like me, believed that idle was just three greater than symbols in your terminal, now you know it's a little bit more. Not a lot more. I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying it exists. And that's something. I came across a blog the other day that I think it's actually connected somehow vaguely to the GNOME project. I'm not saying it's an official GNOME project blog, but I think it's a blog of a developer who works on GNOME, I think. I could be wrong. It was a blog, and it's usually got a lot of technical content, which is why it's in my feed at all. But the topic that kind of popped up in the blog post that sort of caught my eye, just because it's been a topic lately, was about paying for journalism, actually. So it was obviously non-technical. And this isn't actually what I want to talk about, but it kind of caught my attention because it's something that I'm starting to notice cropping up in a couple of different places, really, as I've talked about already in this season. And I've gotten feedback from a few people now about the concept of, yeah, how is this stuff going to get paid for? So paying for journalism in the blog post was kind of a thing where he was deciding, yes, he's going to start paying for journalism, like paying for news, essentially, because he felt like that was something that was important to perpetuate and to support. And I think, very broadly speaking, I think that's probably an ideal that a lot of us actually do have, and that is the idea that in a perfect system, the things that people enjoy would be supported by people. And I think what has happened in the real world is that what happens is that a lot of people appear to enjoy something, and so a government steps in and uses tax money to support that thing. So that's obviously outside the scope of a technical podcast such as this one. I'm just saying that I think more often than not, people feel like, I do like that thing. I would like it if everybody around me would support that thing so that that thing continues. And I don't know how many people really love the concept of taxes. That's why I'm saying I think that's the ideal, is that we all just kind of spontaneously decide that thing is worth supporting, and so we're going to support it sufficiently enough that it continues. Because nobody really wants to pay taxes, and nobody wants their neighbor to have to pay taxes for something that their neighbor doesn't want to support. So it's really kind of this squishy area where we all kind of just want everyone to agree and support the thing that I happen to like. And obviously that's not necessarily what happens. That's kind of asking a lot for things to spontaneously be agreed upon sufficiently that everyone kind of throws money at the same thing. Happily throws money at it. So there's that. Now, I'm obviously thinking of this less in terms of quality journalism, as I'm thinking of it in regards to content on the internet and even software, really. And the thing that I was kind of thinking about was that as a free software enthusiast, I strongly believe in the idea that software should be $0. So it should be free in the traditional, you know, liberated sense that we talk about it as, but it should also be free in the sense that it should not cost money. And why shouldn't it cost money? I mean, that's kind of a weird thing that gets that got built into the Linux community, you know? It's just kind of like this fairly widespread conviction that stuff for Linux should not cost. And I'm starting to get this feeling that there's a movement within the community that's almost saying, well, we don't actually think that anymore. We're starting to want to throw money at things that we like. But wherever such a movement exists, I think that there's the perpetual movement underneath that of people who simply can't or won't give money for something. But I think that's normal. Like, I think it's more normal for us to have a split. For us to say, well, I want to pay money for this. And then to have two people next to us saying, I'm not going to pay for that. I think that's a normal community of computer users. And I think it's actually abnormal to have a whole community of people who simply say, money should not exchange hands for this product ever, no matter what. And I'm not saying one is better than the other. I'm just saying that as a computer user, before I even realized there was software out there to be had for $0, I think the typical model, I don't want to call it a business model, but the typical economic model was that some people paid for stuff and some people didn't. And we all know what I'm talking about, right? I mean, we've all been there probably. Certainly as a college student who simply just could not pay. Like, if I paid for software as a college student, I would have not eaten or I would have not paid rent. And that just doesn't really work. Now, you could argue quite fairly, and I would probably argue this with you, against my historical self, that I really didn't have to be in college. I didn't have to be living where I was living. And, you know, like, if I'd had my priorities straight, if I'd really known what my priorities were, and I didn't at the time, but if I'd known, then I would have not, you know, I would have adjusted, and there wouldn't have been that conflict. There wouldn't have been the thing of, oh my gosh, I must have this software, and must have is in huge air quotes, must have, I need, more quotes, this software, therefore I will download it over, you know, whatever network, and in that way I can have it, and I can also do my schoolwork, and then everyone wins, except the people who are asking for money for this software. And as I've said before, I think I've said this on this show, and if not, I've said it elsewhere, I think that the model really should be that if someone has asked for money for something, then you give them money for that thing. And if you don't want to give them money for that thing, then you don't want the thing. Because that's part of the condition, is that they want money for that thing. And that goes for lots of different things. It goes for software. It goes for art. It goes for lots of things. It goes for, you know, cars and purses and bicycles. If you don't want the thing, then you don't do anything with it. You don't get the thing if you don't, you know, but if you want it, then you have to, you do pay. It's just part of the way that human nature works. It's someone with a good says, here's my requirements to give this thing up. And the person who wants that good has to meet those requirements. And I'm not saying this trying to create the idea or perpetuate the idea that software is a thing, or that digital artwork is a thing, because it's not, and we know that it's complex recipes on how to recreate a thing reliably over a digital medium. And if that digital medium goes away, then those things will go away, you know. I mean, like, if I obtain some software, I might be very excited to have that software, but if I don't have a computer, then I've acquired essentially nothing. If I acquire a digital music file that will play back digital music for me, and I don't have a computer or a device that can reproduce those, you know, that can decode that algorithm that will then create the music that I'm expecting to hear, then I've got nothing. So there's no sense of theft in the sense that, oh, I've taken something that is not mine, because it's just bits. But there is a sense of, well, I've taken something without meeting the requirements that someone has outlined for me to use that product. And you can argue, and again, I would be with you on this one, that the burden of preventing ownership of something digital is really on the creator of that digital item. And I think that's a little bit different than in the physical world, because although maybe it's not really. I mean, we have keys for cars, and we have locks on bikes and things like that. You know, I mean, it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and you kind of have to hang on to what you own, or people will take it from you, which sounds horrible, and it is horrible. It's a horrible way to live, but that's how we all live. That's kind of what's going on, and we tend to lock our things up in a house, or in a van, or in a chest, or to a pole, you know, and we these are things that we own, and we don't leave them lying around. And I feel like in the digital world, someone somehow forgot to post that message, kind of like, hey, if you've got a digital object, you should make sure that people cannot just walk off with a copy of your digital object. And, you know, people have done that. Companies have tried. The audio software out there traditionally has been just actually really really good with copy sort of protection or whatever. They famously are horrible. You have digital keys, dongles that you have to plug into your computer, and if that USB dongle is not present on your system when you launch that audio software or while you use that audio software, then that thing will not work. And if you lose that dongle, then you cannot use your audio software. So it's really a hardware key with software on it, you know, and to enable a certain functionality. So, and there are other companies, of course, that don't do it. And you to the degree that you have to almost wonder if they're not doing it on purpose, you know, like Adobe, I would say, and even Apple, famously, I think. Have had traditionally very poor management of this sort of thing, where you can, you know, copy one single self-contained file for some fairly expensive Apple software, and it will run. That's it. That's all you need. You're not going to get updates for it without knowing your little login and stuff. But I mean. Or maybe you'll get updates, but you can't upgrade. Maybe that's what it is. But still, you know, it's in terms of sort of, can I purchase this once and then distribute it many times? Yes, you can. And the same way goes for Adobe. I mean, that's how Photoshop, I would argue, became the de facto solution for graphic editing, really. It's just this extreme kind of negligence on Adobe's part to actually ensure that people who didn't purchase Photoshop aren't then running Photoshop. So yeah, there's a little bit of an economy there, and the solution to that economy is to encourage and enable and ensure theft of some sort, or dishonesty. Let's call it dishonesty, because it's not theft, but it is dishonesty, right? You have put a price tag on it as the programmer, and programmers have worked on that software, and they've given their time and their hard work and their effort. And then you, as the point of sale, have failed to do your due diligence to ensure that those software programmers are getting paid. And then, of course, you're self-righteously blaming everyone else. You're just saying, well, this, you know, we can't do this because everyone's stealing our software. And it's kind of like, well, yeah, sure they are, but you also haven't actually done anything to prevent them from doing that. Which is why I love subscription models for closed-source software, because that truly, truly is a very pure representation of what's happening. You are not actually buying the software. You are subscribing to the continued support of that software. I think it's great, actually. It's really, really good. It's the best worst thing to ever happen, because it's finally impressing upon people the fact that you didn't buy that software. You've subscribed to that company. And if that company ever goes away, or if you ever stop paying that company, then your data is now inaccessible to you. And that's good. It's good. It's honest. So obviously that's the kind of thing that a free software enthusiast would not want to get involved with. And as someone who got into free software and then, you know, completely unofficially, you know, I just kind of, I'm a hobbyist really, but I have managed in whatever small way to transform the hobby into something that that pays. You know, it makes me money now, one way or the other. And as someone who has done that, I'm definitely not on board with the idea of restricting anyone else from doing that same thing. So I would never want there to be a software out there that is available only if you have open source software that is available only if you pay for it. Like, that would be really, really bad. And at the same time, I also wouldn't want that to become an enabling methodology or an excuse to enable kind of that dishonest / theft culture that exists in closed source software. So I wouldn't want there to be, let's pick on Ardour, because they're doing it really, really well. So let's say that there's an Ardour copy out there on the Ardour.org website. Ardour is a digital audio workstation. So like for professional music creation, kind of like Qtractor, but like Audacity on steroids. If you've never used it, just know that it's an audio software, and it's fairly pro level. It's not really something that, you know, if you're downloading Audacity and you're happy with that, then you're probably not the target audience. So it's something that someone would want to seek out because they need something more than sort of the obvious solution. So Ardour, if there's a copy of Ardour out there, and it's let's say it's $60 for a download, and it's the download includes the binary that is going to run on your system. It includes updates for bug fixes and things like that, and probably maybe, well, all updates within that series, I think, is how he does it. And so you've got this software, and you can pay $60 for it, and that's great. Now, let's say that there was no other way to get Ardour. I mean, it's open source, so there would be another way to get it, which is download the source code and compile it and then go from there. And that actually seems really, that seems pretty reasonable to me. Now, because people are people, what would probably also happen is that people would download the source code, compile, and then share it with their friends as a compiled binary, which is, to, you know, some level a dishonest, or at least it's a disingenuous thing to do, because the original author is asking $60 and now you're giving it away sort of behind his back. And I feel like if you went out to eat at get a cup of coffee with Paul, who writes or Ardour, you would probably not be able to maybe, you'd probably offer to buy his cup of coffee for him, you know, kind of like, because you'd know in the back of your mind, I've been giving your software away for free, this is kind of awkward, here, let me get that for you, you know, that kind of thing. It might not cause you any unrest, but at the same time, if you really got to know Paul as a person, you'd start to feel guilty about it eventually. Unless you're a completely soulless human being and you just don't care, which, I mean, that happens too. But I'm just saying, like, assuming the best, I think after a while you would start to feel bad about your choice to redistribute software that clearly an author has put a lot of effort into and is now currently asking, you know, money for. But the fear, I think, there, the eternal fear for us open source geeks, is this idea that that someone will, you know, rise up through the ranks of the horrible education system that is public schooling. They will come out on the other side. They'll think, oh man, I want to become a musician, and I know that everyone's using computers now for music recording and stuff. And I don't have a dime to my name, but I've downloaded this great thing. It's called Linux, and apparently I can make music on it. And Audacity is just not quite cutting it. I really need something a little bit more, you know, that can do MIDI, that can have dynamically loaded plugins and, you know, effects and, you know, the things that music, that an audio workstation ought to do, sequencing. So they go to download Ardour, and of course it's $60. They don't have $60. They don't even have $10, much less $60. And so now what? You know, and there's this terrible fear, I think, in a lot of us open source geeks that, yeah, we're going to be the roadblock that closed source was for us. And that's the main fear, I think. And it's really dangerous to even flirt with that for me, because I never want that to happen. As someone who has benefited so strongly from the $0-ness of Linux and its entire sort of offering, that's just not something I want to ever say that I've been responsible for. Now, the good news is that we can have it both ways, I think. And I think that Ardour in its own way has really done this really, really well. And it's not the only solution, but it is a good solution, and it seems to be working out pretty well. Ardour does charge $60 for a normal license, and it does charge $1 for a download. So if you have $1 to give, you can download Ardour, and you are completely within your moral obligation. You have met the requirements of that download. And I think external of any kind of legal system, that's what's important. That you have looked at the person offering this thing, you've looked at the list of requirements, and the list of requirements is $1. And I think other programs have done this as well, like LibreOffice, I think, has given, you know, has a pay what you will kind of offering. What else does? I think Ubuntu was doing this for a while, weren't they? They were doing, like, when you would click on the Ubuntu link, it would say, hey, you want to give money to us? And then I think you could even adjust where the money went and all kinds of things. And I don't know how well it always works. I think Ardour is a little bit of a little bit of a special case, because it does have a very specific audience, and its audience kind of has built up a relationship with Paul, the author of Ardour, and they kind of know him and they trust him and he knows them. And it really is a very, from at least from my view, and I'm not heavily involved in Ardour community or anything, because I don't, as much as I love it, I don't actually use it. I use Qtractor just because it fits my style better, I guess. But it's a very, very healthy community from what I can see, and it's got a good relationship with the developer, and he's very active and he's very knowledgeable, and and I don't know that he's completely supported by the Ardour downloads. You know, I know that he has deals in place with other, like, Mixbus and stuff like that. So I don't know, you know, I don't have his tax statements in front of me. In other words, I don't know where his income is coming from. But I do think that in terms of kind of reaching that ideal of, yes, we need money, no, we don't want to be a blockade to people, I think Ardour is really doing a great job. And there are other, like I say, there are other projects that do it really well. I think Synfig is doing it really well. I don't know how directly it is Synfig, but someone from the Merevna project has got a Patreon, and so you can give money through Patreon on a regular basis, and for each update you're giving money, and it works out really, really nicely. There are a couple of different projects out there that are on Patreon at this point. There's a GIMP developer who's on Patreon, so you can just kind of throw little bits of money at these projects on a periodic basis, and it's pretty easy to do. but it also ensures that people who cannot throw money at them still get to benefit from those projects. It may not be a perfect solution yet. It might be. I don't know. I'm not someone trying to live off of my work on software. Well, I guess I am. I'm saying it, and as I'm saying it, I'm realizing, oh my gosh, yes, I am. But I mean, I have a job. You know, I got hired by somebody to pay me to do stuff, so that's great. And then there are other developers who are just working absolutely full time on this stuff and doing amazing work. And yeah, they're going to need payment, and some of us are going to have to pay for that. It's just one of those things. And as much as the ideal might be that we don't pay for it and we don't pay, it might be ideal that we don't even have money, you know, like that'd be great. Completely different economy. But the reality is, obviously, you know, if we want these libraries to get updated and if we want these applications to continue to be developed, the person has to get a paycheck from some place. And so the enablement of pay is actually, I think, a feature, and it's a feature that's still developing, but I think it's an important one, and I do hope that people continue to find new and creative but meaningful ways to enable those who can pay for stuff to then pay for stuff. And I think that I'm not alone in the when I say that I definitely pay more money now on computer stuff and on software specifically than I ever did when I was using a closed source system. I've heard other people say this, you know, and it's partly because of timing. You know, I didn't find Linux until after college and until after. Well, that's not true. It was actually, I think there was a little bit of overlap there. Well, not really. Yeah, so basically until after college, and then I didn't pay for anything, and then I finally started getting work, and then I started paying, I would say paying stuff back, really, to Linux, to the community. And I don't know what I would have done, you know, if I was still using closed software, a closed system now, I don't know what I'd be doing. I know that I developed an aversion to being blackmailed for software. That never sat well with me. There was always kind of a resentment between me and the software that I was using, because I knew that if I didn't pay, all of my stuff was going to disappear. So I don't know how I would feel about that if I was not on Linux now. I don't know how I would feel. And I do feel like one of the things that encourages and makes it a pleasure to pay for the software that I'm using now is that I know that whether I pay or not, my data is still my data. I mean, I don't imagine necessarily that the software is going to get updated, because I know that people have to have day jobs. And maybe if I pay, maybe that'll help. But I do know that the data itself is safe. And that's, I think, ultimately at the end of the day, that's what people really want, is their data. And then ultimately at the end of the day, they want to feel good about paying for something. They you know, it's the psychology of whether you're being asked to pay for something or whether you're being bullied into being paid for something. And I think open source software is creative enough and healthy enough that it can find a way to make people happy to pay when they can, rather than bullying people into it. And that's an important distinction.